On this week's 51%, the Food and Drug Administration recently decided to remove black box warnings from the packaging of hormonal therapies used to treat symptoms of menopause. We speak with internist Dr. Heather Hirsch about the change.
There are so many myths and misconceptions about menopausal hormone therapy, and it was also a huge barrier for some women to start or even be prescribed hormone therapy on the prescriber's side.
We also dive into Dr. Hirsch's new book, The Perimenopause Survival Guide. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. The Food and Drug Administration recently decided to remove its black box warning labels from the packaging of hormonal therapies used to treat symptoms of menopause. Black box warnings are the most serious labels the FDA can put on a product. They don't necessarily mean it's categorically unsafe, but that they come with certain risks. The FDA has had black box warnings on hormonal therapies since the early 2000s, after a study called the Women's Health Initiative found they could contribute to an increased risk of breast cancer, heart attacks, and stroke. For years, though, doctors have been poking holes in this study and arguing that hormonal therapy improves the health of menopausal women. Our guest today is one of them. Dr. Heather Hirsch is a board-certified internist and the founder of the Menopause Clinic at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. She has a long career of helping women navigate menopause and the various treatment options available, including FDA-approved hormone therapies. When used by women of a specific age and with specific formulations, Dr. Hirsch says hormonal therapy is a safe and effective option for those struggling with hot flashes, brain fog, poor sleep, and more. Earlier this year, she spoke on a panel urging the administration to ditch the black box warnings. The FDA's decision comes just as she's released her newest guide to midlife, called the Perimenopause Survival Guide. Make sense of your symptoms and build your personalized treatment plan.
So in July of this year, I was invited to be on an expert panel, and the expert panel was made up of 12 clinicians, and we were in all different specialties. So we had internal medicine, I'm internal medicine, OBGYN, urology, we even had an orthopedic surgeon. And the point of the expert panel was to help the FDA commissioner, Dr. Marty McCarry, really gather more information to go back to the FDA. And we brought up two big points here. And the first is that when it came to menopausal hormone therapy, the reason that these black box warnings were what we were kind of considered outdated was, you know, from 2002, when the black box warning was placed on them, we looked at two major things here. And the first is that those warnings didn't apply to women who started within 10 years of menopause. So the timing at which you started hormone therapy really mattered. Now, we hope that the majority of women start hormone therapy within 10 years, because that's actually typically when they have the most symptoms. And that number two, the formulation of hormones that you used also really mattered. And this, for example, depends on what type of progesterone or estrogen you use. These are blanket words, but there are synthetic progestins, and then there's progesterone, or what we call a more natural or bioidentical form of progesterone. And those two things, the time at which a woman would start hormone therapy and the formulation of hormone therapy that she would use, actually, if you did those things and you used more modern approaches, started within 10 years and used different formulations, not only were those risks not adequate, but really women mostly get benefits. So we really wanted to argue that these black box warnings were too broadly spread on menopausal hormone therapy. So that was really, really important. The second was for systemic hormone therapy. When we look at vaginal estrogen, which is actually placed locally and does not travel through the whole body, these box label warnings also did not scientifically make any sense, because they don't increase the risk of breast cancer, heart attacks, strokes, or probable dementia, because they don't travel systemically. So we wanted to argue for the removal on both. And then after that panel, we didn't hear terribly much until early in November. And I got word that I was invited to head back to the FDA to do a separate podcast with Dr. Marty McCarry on this topic. And then, of course, we had the box label removal on both systemic and vaginal estrogen in early November. And, You know, I could talk about this clearly. I have made this a very long run-on paragraph. But why this is so important is because there are so many myths and misconceptions about menopausal hormone therapy. And the box label warning that was placed on these medications is the highest safety warning that the government could put on a medication. And it simply really didn't apply for those reasons already stated. And it was also a huge barrier for some women to start or even be prescribed hormone therapy on the prescriber's side. So the removal of the box label warning was a really big signal. And actually, just to clarify, what the government actually decided to do was say, we no longer require this box label warning on menopausal hormone therapy, and we're going to bring this back to the pharmacies to each decide where they want to put risks of their medications in their inserts. And so I think, too, this was much more of a responsible way to do it.
You've covered this a little bit, but I want to talk a little bit more about how we got here. So I guess, why were these black box warnings put on hormone therapy in the first place?
So we're always going to point to those two big things, the time at which women start and then the formulation of hormone therapy that women use. So in the 90s and even in the late 80s, most women were given menopausal hormone therapy, typically an estrogen and then plus a progesterone if you had your uterus. And around the time of menopause, and found that they were living longer, had less heart disease, and better bone health. So the thought was, well, it's obvious that estrogen is helpful. And then they decided to do the gold standard of trials, which is a randomized blinded study. That means that women were randomized and even either given hormone therapy or placebo. Now, when they did that, what's really important to know is that they got women who are on average 12 or 13 years out of menopause. But at the time, they didn't know that the timing was really crucial. Turns out that women in their early 50s are very busy and they didn't have time to get all their blood drawn and do all their testing. And so they actually got an older cohort of women. In fact, the women were aged 50 to 79. So that was one big thing. And they used one formulation in the Women's Health Initiative, Premarin or conjugated equine estrogen only if you didn't have a uterus, and then PremPro or conjugated equine estrogen with a synthetic progestin, medroxyprogesterone acetate. And those formulations are also important. So those would be the two things I keep coming back to. So after the study went for 5 years, they found there was a slight increased risk of breast cancer in the women in the PremPro arm. But the media reported this as a relative risk of a 26% increased risk of breast cancer. If you were a laywoman reading that, you would think that means one in four women were getting breast cancer. But the absolute risk was two to four women out of 1,000 women over 5 years on that one combination of oral PremPro at that dose. But the damage was done, and this box label warning was slapped on all of menopausal hormone therapy, saying that it increased the risk of breast cancer. Now, the box label warning also said it could increase the risk of cardiovascular disease, stroke, and dementia. And at the time when this media report came out, they also noted that there was some increased risks of cardiovascular disease and stroke, but they were mostly seeing this in the older women. But it wasn't until years later that they realized that the timing is very important. So those box labels were slapped on all of hormone therapy. Now, interestingly, the women in the estrogen-only arm who were taking conjugated equine estrogen only and not the synthetic progestin, who didn't have a uterus, that's why they could take estrogen only, they were having actually reductions in breast cancer compared to the women in the placebo. So that is actually really, really interesting. And that's kind of where this warning came. And it was really slapped across all formulations of hormone therapy. Now, when scientists sat back and thought, the women in the conjugated equine estrogen only arm were doing really well. Maybe it wasn't the estrogen that was the problem. Maybe it was the synthetic progestin. And when they do different studies using micronized natural progesterone or Prometrium, a more naturally based progesterone, they don't see any increased risk of breast cancer above baseline. And women who start within 10 years, studies show actually can have reductions in cardiovascular disease, reductions in death from all causes, reductions in heart attacks, and improvement in bones, as well as reduction in diabetes. So those two things are really, really important. And that's kind of where all of this fear really stemmed from in the early 2000s.
You say the timing you start hormone therapy is important within 10 years of menopause. I just want to make sure that I'm understanding properly. So do you mean like within 10 years after menopause or before? I guess technically, I guess when you're in perimenopause.
So great question. Let's clarify too, like these definitions, because, you know, we use these and even I will, you know, kind of interchangeably. Menopause technically is one day of a woman's life. It's when she's had 365 days or 1 year of no periods or bleeding. And that day she can say, this is menopause. And every day after that is postmenopause. So the idea of hormone therapy actually is after menopause, we want to start you on your hormone therapy, ideally within 10 years from your last period. Now, perimenopause is all the time leading up to that, where a woman might start to experience symptoms or change in periods. And so perimenopause is also a crazy time, can also last a good, you know, 5 to 7 or 10 years. Now, you can start menopausal hormone therapy in perimenopause. And I talk a lot about that in my new book, The Perimenopause Survival Guide. But when it comes to the best time to start hormone therapy to get the benefits, it's definitely anytime before that 10-year mark of your last period.
Well, let's talk about perimenopause and your new book, as you said, The Perimenopause Survival Guide. What kinds of symptoms can women face during perimenopause, and what's going on in the body to cause them?
Absolutely. So I was actually doing a report and comparing puberty to perimenopause. And this is so interesting because also a lot of women going through perimenopause may have daughters who are going through puberty just based on the timing of the woman's reproductive cycle. And when you think about a woman's first period and you're thinking about the development of that hypothalamic pituitary ovarian axis, where you're waiting for a woman to, whenever age you first get your period, you're waiting for those periods to really become normal. And we can see that can take 5, 7, you know, even a decade. Women might routinely say, I started my period at 12 and it really wasn't until college that it became more regular, right? And so you could think of that as a finite time in your life for your listeners and think that perimenopause is the same thing, only it's winding down. And that explains why it can take 5, 7, 10 years, and it's different for everybody. But essentially that message from the brain to the ovaries to produce a follicle or an egg, which makes estrogen, it starts to kind of get delayed. And especially because the ovaries are kind of setting up for a little bit of R&R or retirement or menopause, as we say. And so what's happening then is that the ovaries, if they're not responding and they're not making those follicles and you're not releasing estrogen, you're having a decline in estrogen levels. And when estrogen starts to decline, and it's, I always have to be the bearer of bad news here in many ways, that affects us from head to toe. So that can cause hot flashes and night sweats, brain fog, mood changes, dry skin, all sorts of symptoms, even vaginal dryness and pain with intercourse. And that actually can all start while a woman may still be menstruating, because every once in a while that egg's working and, you know, but that's also why periods sometimes start to change. And that can be one of the earlier symptoms. Also, progesterone starting to decline, as is your testosterone, because they're all kind of getting signals from each other. And they're like, okay, well, maybe it's time to quiet down here. And so as those hormones also start to decline, you can experience other symptoms. So low progesterone can sometimes cause anxiety and insomnia. But what I find so interesting about perimenopause and why I wanted to write a whole book about it is because we often think about menopause as like our moms or our grandmothers, and you could be in your early 40s or even your late 30s and these symptoms are happening and you're thinking, what is wrong with me? I must be going crazy. Why am I gaining weight or having brain fog or not sleeping? And then so many women, because we don't think about our hormones at this time, because we might actually still be getting periods somewhat regularly, or maybe like me, you don't get periods because you've had either a uterine ablation or you have an IUD in place so you don't have an unintended pregnancy. You're just kind of not thinking about your hormones the same way that maybe we should. And that was kind of the point of writing this book, is to say, hey, these things can start to happen when we're still having periods. What are some of the signs and symptoms? Because then, you know, when women don't put these together, because neither are their clinicians, we can talk about that as well. They're often then kind of, you know, seeing 5, 6, 7 different clinicians, starting medications for the wrong diagnoses, and not really getting the support and the help that they need.
You say everyone's experience can look different. I guess I'm just wondering why that is. Like, why is there such a range of symptoms for everyone?
Great question. And we don't know the answer to that, although I think it probably comes down to simply genetics. I say that because it is great to be healthy, of course, to exercise and to be mindful and to get good sleep and to eat well and, avoid processed foods and sugars. However, it is a myth that if you are super healthy, that you won't experience these symptoms. And so therefore, that's one reason why we know genetics probably play a huge role. So maybe that means you have more estrogen receptors in the part of your brain that regulates emotion, let's say, and it's used to being saturated with estrogen. And as that estrogen declines, this may make you feel like you have a lower mood, anhedonia, lack of joy, or depression. And maybe another woman just doesn't have those receptors there. And so she's kind of less affected mood-wise. Maybe you have more receptors in the hypothalamus than another person, and that's what controls the heat or the hot flashes, the vasomotor instability. And that might be one reason why some people have that versus the other. So we don't know. And this is a great question because we need more research, and we simply don't have enough. And I could even go so far as to argue that the box label warning on menopausal hormone therapy was a barrier to getting more research done, because to get something through an IRB or an institutional review board was a little bit harder when these medications were deemed, unsafe. And so that's probably comes down to genetics. Now, some people might have more flexible genetics, and so if they eat healthy and they exercise, that definitely can help to alleviate some of the symptoms. So we're not saying that lifestyle is not important at all. Of course it is. But again, I think this is a very important question. I would love a world where a woman could kind of have some predictive medicine where she could just kind of put things in and sort of say, oh, your menopause is going to be at 52, and these are going to be your top symptoms, and this is going to be the best treatment for you. But as for now, it's one of the reasons that as I write my books, I try to write them in clusters of symptoms, because I think there's probably some similarities in either the phenotype or the genotype of these women where they experience these symptoms in clusters. And while it's not perfect, it's my best shot at, say, precision medicine when I write a book.
So which symptoms do you usually see, I guess, clustering together?
So, when I wrote Unlock Your Menopause Type, which we got to talk about in 2023 when that came out, I had six types there. And briefly, that was premature menopause, which is important because this is physiologically much different if you're under age 40 or even 45. Sudden menopause, if you had surgery or chemotherapy, the mind and mood type of menopause, where mood symptoms are your biggest symptom. We talked about seemingly never ending, full throttle, exactly what it sounds like, and then silent menopause. And so when I did Perimenopause Survival Guide, I kind of used that same through line here. If I wanted to see if I could kind of cluster them a little bit so that women could maybe read that chapter first. So the chapters that I have in Perimenopause Survival Guide are much different. For example, the first one is, bleeding till you drop. So that might not be in the menopause book, but there are some women for whom this heavy bleeding and this new onset of like cramping and pain that makes them feel like they're in high school again is their biggest symptom in perimenopause. The next chapter was lying awake and worrying. And this is more about this anxiety and insomnia. And I alluded to the fact that this can happen, particularly as progesterone declines. There's kind of the dragging yourself through life, which is just fatigue and a lack of motivation. There's the feeling unrecognizable to yourself, which has to do with more like this brain fog, these cognitive changes. Women will report worsening ADHD-like symptoms, just not feeling like they can complete tasks anymore, or they can't remember people's names, things like that. It's really worrisome to them, although all normal. Then the next one is gaining weight for no apparent reason, and a lot of weight gain can start in perimenopause. And then I also included silent perimenopause, because even if, you're listening to this or a friend has sent it to you and you're thinking, I don't think I've experienced anything yet, There could be, you know, that could be true. About 10 to 15% of women don't experience symptoms, but your body is still changing. And in perimenopause, it's amping up for a whole new chapter. And in menopause, you still need to know how it's going to impact your brain, your heart, and your bones. And so I really wrote both of my books that way. It makes me smile because I think it's kind of a fun way to do it. I think these books make for great sort of book club where women can, you know, talk to each other, because the more we talk and the more we break the taboo and really, you know, keep women from feeling this old silence around it, really the better we're going to do as a society.
I mean, is there one tip that you would recommend all women do regardless of their symptoms?
Something very simple, which is just journaling and tracking your symptoms. That can kind of help us because we all have a very bad, you know, like retention bias. We can't even remember what happened a week ago, let alone 4 months ago or a year ago. And so even if you are on a birth control, I'll have women, let's say, who take birth control pills, and they will do great. And then all of a sudden, let's say they hit 41, and all of a sudden they're noticing, you know, they're having anxiety or they're having hot flashes. And it's still a difference from, you know, let's say they've been on them for a long time. And so it's important to kind of know what symptoms are you having and when did they start. If you have an intrauterine device or an ablation, you really don't get periods. But if you start to kind of track and you sort of say, gosh, every 28 to 32 days, I'm really anxious for a week and I can't sleep, there's some cyclic pattern there. And so you can kind of think maybe this is more perimenopause, because women's hormones will cycle through the month. And so even if you're on birth control or not, or if you're on a medication that stops your periods or not, simply journaling and tracking is really, really helpful. And just like you already mentioned, it's so different for every woman. The symptoms that they will experience, how long they last for, what makes them better, what makes them worse. And only you know where it's impacting your quality of life. And once it starts to impact your quality of life more days than not, that's really when I say you should seek treatment.
We're speaking with Dr. Heather Hirsch, author of the Perimenopause Survival Guide. We've been going through the various symptoms of perimenopause, the period before menopause that can start as early as your late 30s and last up to 10 years. If you don't seek treatment for these symptoms, does that impact your experience in menopause or I guess post-menopause? I guess what kinds of long-term health implications can menopause cause?
This is also a wonderful question. And this is always where I want to say there is no one right way to treat menopause or perimenopausal symptoms. But we do know for sure that if you're suffering with symptoms that are debilitating, that are impacting your ability to sleep well or function well during the day, sticking it out is only going to derail your health. And that's the hardest part, kind of, I think, also for women. One, we've been told just stick it out. It's natural. Like my mom did it. Or, you know, moms will tell their daughters, oh, it was fine. Just, you know, it's a normal part of life. However, we know that if women have more vasomotor symptoms, that actually, if they're untreated, you can actually increase your risk for cardiovascular disease. So think about this. A hot flash is basically your vessels squeezing and then releasing and then squeezing and then releasing. And that's probably not good for you, right? And so sticking out something like vasomotor symptoms actually can derail your health. And again, if they start in perimenopause, research shows that they will last longer. And so that's actually something that you want to know, because if you didn't know that those symptoms could last 10 or 15 years, and you're just getting 3 years in and someone's like, this is going to go on for a lot longer, you might say, okay, I need treatment now. If you're not sleeping, we know that women who don't get restful sleep for 7 to 9 hours, not just laying in bed 7 to 9 hours, but restful sleep, actually that's going to shorten their health span, which is how long you live a healthy life. And so it's really, really important that women know whatever treatment plan they want to go down. And it could be over-the-counter supplements and lifestyle. Now, those certainly will have their limitations just because you astutely asked. Sometimes you just can't out genetics. You know, you can't meditate enough to sometimes stop the hot flashes. Then there's non-hormonal medications, and then there's hormonal therapy medications. But I really want women to know that this idea, this mantra that suffering it or sticking it out, you get some metal, because you don't. And actually, it can derail your health and shorten your health span.
One thing I hear a lot from women is this sort of, you know, difficulty of having conversations with their doctors or getting the results that they hoped for from their doctors. Specifically from some women in my family, I've heard them say they've gone to their doctor about their symptoms and were basically told, oh yeah, there's medicine for that, but really like nothing more. Like they weren't able to get in an in-depth conversation about what they're experiencing or what their options are. I guess, do you have any advice for those wanting to get the most out of their appointments?
So in my book, The Perimenopause Survival Guide, I talk about how I recommend you call your clinician and you say, I want to make a separate visit to discuss, insert perimenopause or menopause. And that way you're not doing it at your annual exam, because at your annual exam, your clinician's already got a list of things that he or she needs to do. And it's sort of hard because as a physician myself, you know, and as an internist, you know, trying to get everything done at your annual visit and then have this whole conversation, it leaves you with only a few minutes to spare, and simply that's not enough. So make a whole separate visit if you can. I know that means another day off of work or another Zoom call, but it also makes for a great telemedicine visit. Number two, if you've been journaling and tracking, this is where that gold comes in, because you're going to come right to your clinician and in the first 3 minutes say, I've been having this symptom and this symptom and this symptom. And so insert night sweats, vaginal dryness, and brain fog for the last 6 months. It's worse, you know, the week before my period, I have tried meditating, as we've said many times on this show. And I've tried an over-the-counter supplement and it has not been alleviating these symptoms. And so that's point number two. Then point number three is, you say, this is impacting my quality of life, and I do believe this could be perimenopause or menopause. And then that's kind of when you ask your clinician, how familiar are you with this topic and treatment options? And now already you've taken up just 3 minutes and you've got a whole, hopefully, you know, 15 or 20 minutes left just to talk about this topic. Then if you're already listening to this show, or if this is something that's impacting your life and you send it to a friend, if you come in with some information, be it some of the great books that are out there, or you've listened to a few of the great podcasts out there, and I always advocate for evidence-based medicine and FDA-approved treatment options. So we're not talking compounded medications or pellet medications. We're talking about medications, whether they're hormonal or non-hormonal, but that you can get at a commercial pharmacy. And you should then kind of, after your doctor answers, say, you know, I've been thinking about, insert kind of what treatment option you're thinking about, and I would like to discuss this with you. And then attempt to have a conversation with your clinician. And there's a reason why. If you find that it's not satisfactory, do ask for a referral. And nowadays, we do have telemedicine companies. We've got concierge medic companies. I have my own practice, and there are great places to go for a second opinion. I absolutely also want to plug something called the heatherhirschdirectory.com, because I also have trained thousands of clinicians on FDA-approved menopausal hormone therapy, and if they've taken my courses, they're listed there. So there definitely is great places to get a second opinion. But the reason I do tell women to start with their clinician is because this is really important. It's doing two things. Number one, I do think most women would love if their primary care or their OBGYN was prescribing these medications for them, because they know their whole history and they want them to be on board with what they're doing. And number two, if you have a clinician who's not comfortable, he or she's going to start to get the message that they need that retraining, right? And I think going back to the beginning of this episode, having that box label removal taken off menopausal hormone therapy was this huge signal that clinicians really have to be retrained or get training in medical school or residencies, which again is actually on the systems, not so much the clinicians themselves. Those conversations that you might have with a clinician who maybe doesn't feel as comfortable as you is really going to help generations of women, because there are now places where they can get that kind of information.
You also give advice in the book about how to talk about perimenopause and menopause with your loved ones. Why is that?
A lot of women will experience in perimenopause, fortunately, they will experience more what I call short fuse-itis or rage. And I think the fortunately was fortunately, I've included in here facts to let you know that that's normal. And as estrogen's declining, this can impact our neurotransmitters like serotonin and dopamine, are happy neurotransmitters. So it's really common. So how do you talk to your family about what you may be experiencing? You know, and I think, you know, even in media or TV shows, women will kind of get poked fun at, like, oh, is it her time of the month, or is, you know, mom kind of going crazy? But we really, I think the way we want to talk to our children about what's happening to our bodies, it's really helpful so that we stop kind of these myths that are not helpful. And then, you know, what I also think is really funny, one of the things I researched for my book here is I was looking at women's health span, and lifespan's how long you live. Health span is how long you live a healthy life. So you want a longer health span. And there's two interventions that have the most data for showing improvements in health span. Now, one is estrogen. And again, not all women need to take hormone therapy. I say this in almost all interviews. I just talk about it so much because I want women to have the facts without the fear before deciding what's right for them. And number two, girlfriends. So community and support is really where we have the second most information on for having a nice health span. And it can be really easy in perimenopause because you're dealing with houses and spouses and kids and parents. You're sandwiched in this time. And it can, you know, really mean your friends fall lower to the priority list. But we know that community and friendship is so vital for health span.
Dr. Heather Hirsch is a board-certified internist, founder of the Menopause Clinic at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and founder of her own concierge telemedicine practice called The Collaborative. Her podcast is Health by Heather Hirsch, and her new book is The Perimenopause Survival Guide: Make Sense of Your Symptoms and Build Your Personalized Treatment Plan. It's out now through Balance Publishers. You can learn more about Heather's work at heatherhirschmd.com. Dr. Hirsch, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
For listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night, bed on the hall.